You're listening to the Ruhi Sleep, Sleep in Society podcast, recorded in Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Sleep in Society. Today, I have with me Ben Robinson. Ben is a coach in functional movement training, a rock climber, father of two small children, an educator, and a student himself. Welcome to Sleep in Society podcast, Ben.
Thanks so much for having me, Ruhi.
Thank you for joining me. We've been meaning to do this for a while, and I'm so happy that we have this opportunity now to talk about functional movement training, motivation, and your own journey to fitness and teaching, and also how things are in terms of being at home with two small children and navigating all of those things that includes training and teaching and educating yourself.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm doing quite well.
Yeah.
Quite well. Yeah. I think as far as you know, the whole gambit of how people could be doing during the pandemic, I'm very well situated. We have a comfortable home. Our financial concerns are mild. We're all healthy. Our kids are happy. And I've never had so much time with my children before. So that's been a real silver lining for me.
Yeah. Are you enjoying the process, being at home with them?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And how's that working out in terms of, are you wrapped up? Did you finish up you're also a student, so you're taking courses and you're also teaching at St. Lawrence as well, right?
That's right. The teaching has concluded until the fall semester. I've submitted my grades, and barring an appeal to the grades that I've posted, I won't have any more work with St. Lawrence College until the beginning of September.
And your own education?
That is ramping up because I probably will never get another opportunity to dedicate significantly more time to school. So my normal method would be to take one course at a time. I'm taking a course right now, but the lofty goal was to finish it, to start and finish in 7 weeks. I think I'll end up finishing in 8 weeks, and then I will take three courses simultaneously afterwards.
Oh, okay. And is that working out well, being at home with the kids? And how old are the kids now, Ben?
The kids are almost three and just over one.
Oh,
so
wow.
So my son, Wynn, he'll be three on the 24th of May, and my daughter, Thomason, turned one on April 5th, which was a very interesting birthday party. We had my parents observing from outside our dining room window as she lit the candles on her cake.
Oh, my. Well, I'm glad at least they were outside the window and not some screen somewhere.
Yeah, me too.
And you have been training on and off for quite a while.
That's right. I met
you first time in 2014, and it was post injury, and then my injury was like I was getting looked after by the physiotherapist and a chiropractor, and then they mentioned something like called functional movement, and I had not heard that term before, and I was introduced to you, and I think you and I trained for about 9 months together in terms of functional movement training. Can we go a little bit about talk about what functional movement training is?
Sure. I'm a big fan of functional movement training, and I follow a very, I guess you could say, a really loose definition of the term functional training. For me, it represents using a training modality that allows the person to optimize their ability to engage in the activities that they do every day. So what is functional for one person could be really different from someone else. But at the core of it, it's a method of training that tries to use the body as close to the manner that you might say it was intended for as possible. So you prioritize what you would call a multi-joint movement over single joint movements. So an easy way of thinking about that would be, as opposed to doing something like a bicep curl, which mm-hmm. isolates the bicep muscles in your upper arm, you would do exercises such as a pull-up or a row, which would engage a larger group of muscles. It involves more changes in joint angle. The demands in terms of coordination are a lot higher, mm-hmm. and it has a larger spillover, or it has a larger benefit in terms of improving other movements and other activities.
Mm-hmm. Now you're working mostly with what age group?
Pre-pandemic, mm-hmm. I was doing some coaching with the rock climbing team in Kingston, and that's ongoing. So that's a younger crowd, teenagers and preteens for the most part. But the bulk of my training sessions would be with adults, I would say 50 and above for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
With probably the highest concentration being between 60 and 75.
Okay, so that's a very interesting age range in terms of movement training. When I first came to you in 2014, I was doing at that point both high intensity interval training and martial arts training at the same time. And I think my training was around 6 days a week. That's why I got injured, because I was utilizing the same muscles without a break. And we had to basically deconstruct all of my movements at that point. And I had to relearn how to move and pay attention to the movement part itself. Because prior to that, you know, I had no idea about how the body coordinates itself. Like I had learned movements. I was doing high intensity training. I was doing martial arts training. But the concept of like proper form was not actually made clear until I actually started training with you, because you're very good at educating as to why certain muscles or joints need to move and how they needed to move. And it actually created a picture in my head that was so clear that every time I moved, I was very clear on what my joints and muscles are supposed to feel. Because prior to that, my understanding of that was very limited, because I did not have one-on-one coaching.
Right.
And that was actually the first time in terms of like actually getting coaching from somebody who was watching you, training you, and making you think about a movement in a very different way. So my question then is that you have this age range of people that are over 60. Now, are they coming to you because they are wanting to move in a different way, or are they coming to you because it's injury related? And that's how they end up coming to you for training.
Right. If it's sometimes due to an injury,
mm-hmm.
more often around, from what I can tell, around 60 or a little bit older is when more and more people have friends who have been injured, and they've watched what that's done to their friends' recreational lives.
Mm-hmm.
So in the even 10 years prior to 60, if you're 50 years old, a lot of times you can suffer a somewhat serious injury, and it'll slow you down for a little bit. It requires, you know, some kind of intervention, surgery, rehab, whatever it is, and then you work your way back into your activity and kind of forget about it. But after 60, for a lot of people, that changes, and the consequences of an injury can get a lot more severe. So frequently when new clients come to see me, they've either suffered an injury that has prevented them from doing what they want to do, or they start to feel the wearing down of their joints, and the activities that they used to find easier feeling harder and harder. And people kind of start to see those doors close in on them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Or often they have, you know, secondhand experience where a friend of theirs has been, you know, a lifetime golfer who has a silly toe injury that ends up ruining their golf game season after season, and eventually they can't play anymore. So the big drive, unfortunately or fortunately for a lot of people, is that fear of injury as they get older, because they recognize, A, that they don't have as much time as they used to do the things they want to do, and two, that the consequences of an injury are a lot more severe now than they would have been when they were younger.
I think, like, for me, I was worried when I got injured, I wasn't able to actually train for quite a while.
Yeah.
And at that point, I was so immersed in the case study that I was doing that was looking at high intensity interval training and its impact on shift work has on one's mental well-being. Exercise for me was a way of keeping that at bay. So the moment that I realized that I wasn't going to be able to train for a while, and I think that was like about a 6-week window, because I was going to rehab, I was so worried about,
yeah,
after that incident and after training with you, my main concern was always not to get injured, how to prevent injury.
Yeah. Well, that's a recipe for success.
Mm-hmm.
That should be at the forefront of everyone's mind, regardless of age. And it's, you know, the relationship between exercise and mental health is becoming clearer and clearer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even just from a, I can speak from a personal perspective right now, because rock climbing is my sport and that's what I like to do, but I'm unable to do it, because we're all staying home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's had a bit of a toll, and I've taken some time to organize other activities that I can do, so I still get that time to engage in exercise. And not everybody shares that passion. You know, everybody has a passion for something, and I would say the lucky ones amongst us, that's a physical activity that we do because of all the benefits it has. But if you're someone who has that, weightlifters call it the iron bug, you know, that need to go out and engage in exercise over and over, it is so fulfilling and it's so all-consuming.
It can be.
And when it's not there, you notice how much of a gap it leaves.
Yeah, and I think that's such an interesting point, because actually, when I did get injured at that point in 2014, and then when I started training with you, and it was I remember it being a very slow progression of training. I so desperately wanted to get back to high intensity training.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was my first thing, was like, when do I get back to my high intensity training? This is taking such a long time. And that if I wasn't able to, for some reason, I strongly associated that my high intensity interval training is keeping all of these other things at bay and keeping me somewhat stable and be mm-hmm. able to do all, you know, be able to juggle all of these things that I'm doing and give me that space. Because in a way, actually, it did give me that space. Because when I did do high-intensity interval training, I was so focused on just training. And it was a way of meditation, because it allowed me that space to just be in my body and nowhere else, and
absolutely
gave me a break from everything else. But again, the thing then that becomes, it's like also becomes this addiction aspect to
yep.
it as well, because, you know, sometimes you have to push your boundaries to then understand, okay, wait, like, you need to learn to create a balance, or need to learn to create an equilibrium.
Absolutely.
And that also
the balance is, yeah, the balance of, you know, volume and intensity and frequency is so critical. One of the things that I've learned more and more the longer that I'm doing personal training is, the percentage of your time that should be spent on really high intensity or really high volume activities is a lot lower than those of us who really enjoy exercise would like it.
Mm-hmm.
Different volumes and different intensities have a different, you can call it, you know, like a mental reward.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally find the high intensity stuff to be the most rewarding. And it's not just the physical feelings that you get from engaging in really high intensity exercise, but it's the intense clarity of mind that can come with it. Because mm-hmm. as you said, everything, body and mind, has to be engaged in what you're doing. But those activities are really draining, both from a, you know, muscle physiology perspective and also from a nervous system perspective. So your nervous system is only going to tolerate a relatively low level of really high intensity exercise. If you push yourself past that limit, your body compensates. So if your leg muscles don't have as much power as mm-hmm. you need for a certain movement, but you want to keep doing it, then your body kind of finds a way to work around that lack of power. And that's one of the areas where injuries creep in. I really like to think about the concept of, you know, mastery in exercise. And that involves so much more restraint than I ever appreciated when I was younger. Now that I'm only in my early 30s, but early 30s is a lot older than early 20s. And I've noticed in my own exercise how much preparation is involved in getting to these short bouts where I can, you know, give the rock climbing or the exercise everything I've got physically and exhaust myself. And then once it's over, there's a long recovery period, lots of rest, lots of nutrition, lots mm-hmm. of sleep, lots of planning, lots of examining how your plan went, how it was successful, how it wasn't. And then you start that whole process over, and there's really probably a, you know, less than 5 or 10% of your time is really spent in those all out high intensity moments. If you're doing things very safely, it'd be 5 or 10%. Maybe.
Yeah. I think that became very clear to me as well. And then how I moved, even though I continued to push my limits and continued to push myself forward, but I was very mindful of being able to listen to when my body was like, okay, that's enough. That's not good pain. Because yeah. I think when I first started the high intensity interval training, I had no concept of what was good pain and what was bad pain.
Right.
And there's also this idea of, like, you know, push through your pain. Was also sitting like on the back of my head, because that was a thing that you're going to feel pain, but you push through your pain. And you know, if I'm doing 400 stairs and I'm feeling like really ill by the 300 stairs, I would still push through mm-hmm. that plateau, because, you know, you listen to, I was paying a lot of attention. I was reading a lot about athletes, and I was reading a lot about high intensity interval training in terms of the data that was coming out of scientific journals, and this idea of resilience, this idea of grit that was really instilled strongly in my head. And I was motivated differently at that point too. And I remember for the first while when I was doing high intensity training that I came very close to throwing up, and I would still push myself until I thought, okay, that point was enough. That was my limit. My limit was, I'm about to throw up, stop. Mm-hmm. But as I trained and I got to know more about it and I started having deeper conversations with people like you and other athletes, I started figuring out, okay, wait, like there's a balance that you have to find within your body, because, you know, it's your body and your mind, and you have to come to those configurations yourself and figure out what is good pain and what is bad pain. And I didn't come to that realization until after I was injured.
That's a hard balance to find. And it's for a lot of people who are really avid exercisers, it's kind of it's a moving target as well, because it changes even just based on how much sleep you've had, how stressed you are, your mm-hmm. age will change it, any previous injuries you've had. But the push through the pain idea, it's pervasive, and it has a place without a doubt within exercise and within training. But it's like I said, the volume at which you want to be doing that is so low. But it's no one wants to watch a YouTube video of, you know, someone very carefully doing an exercise like a bird dog, which is, mm-hmm. you know, an introductory level core exercise, which in my opinion is one of the most beneficial exercises
Absolutely,
someone
it
can
is.
Do.
Yeah.
And so we get a lot of, as people, we get a lot of exposure to how, you know, elite level athletes train, which is not at all the way that most of us should be training.
Exactly,
and we get exposure
yeah.
to our peers. They're more likely to post or share the exercises that they did when they were feeling at their best. And we don't see a lot of all the preparation that goes into that, the recovery that is involved with it, the injuries that are associated with it, and so forth and so on. In some ways, you know, if you are one of the people who's, you know, an exercise junkie and you can't get enough of it, the push through the pain, always high intensity, it's hard physically and it's hard mentally, but from a psychological perspective, it's kind of the easy way because you don't need to show restraint, which is really, really hard to do, particularly if it's an activity that you love so much.
Mm-hmm.
So walking
yeah.
away from the gym after 40 minutes when you really want to keep going because you know you need rest, that's a really hard thing to do. It's not hard for some people. Some people can't wait to get out of the gym. But for those of us who are really into our exercise, it's really hard to walk away when you feel like you have more that you could give to the exercise. But in what I see with athletes, you know, at least 8 out of 10 injuries or even just cases where people don't reach their full potential, it's often due to, you know, the wrong kind of training in terms of exercise selection or what have you, but very often it's too much training. The volume is too high.
I realize that. I thought that was it was made very clear once I actually had a break from it. Once I mm-hmm. realized that weight, that was also high volume, it was high intensity, and not giving yourself that kind of break, and that it's okay, actually, to take a break from this. I think the fear was also because I was afraid that if I stopped or not didn't do it for a couple of days or 3 days, that I wouldn't want to go back to it. Like, the back of
sure.
my brain had that kind of fear behind it, that I'll get caught up in other things of being a parent and shift work and all of those things that I'm doing, and not be able to, that it'll become harder to get back to it. And actually coming to that realization, coming to that no, there is a balance and we can achieve that balance without compromising the quality of training, was actually a revelation.
Right.
And especially, I think, the patience that one needs in terms of slow movement training.
Yeah, patience is critical.
Is incredible. And I think it's another way of training your brain. And I have become, slow movement training has become one of my favorite things right now.
Fantastic.
And I think it's because, and also you and I have been now training for the past 6 months, I believe.
Yes.
And I came back to you because I need to assess my form regardless every few years or so, just because I'm aging. And I ended up coming back to you because my inflammatory markers were going fairly high up. Because as I'm aging, my sleep is seriously impacted. And it's more to do with my gender as a woman as well. And shift mm-hmm. work also had a massive impact. So when I was doing high intensity training fairly hard, well, with good balance of going for long walks and long, you know, and making mm-hmm. sure I had recovery in between. But when I came to you, I remember having this conversation with you at the very beginning, saying, you know, Ben, I need to deconstruct everything I've learned
mm-hmm.
and start my reconstruction process in terms of form and everything, because I want to isolate what is it that I should be doing so my inflammation is at minimal.
Mm-hmm. Exercise is a really interesting, it's a really interesting thing, because it, with the exception of that kind of slow movement and lower intensity stuff, as it makes you, you know, significantly more healthy, it also damages you. And so those breaks are so essential. And any, you know, kind of semi-pro or above athlete, and a lot of general exercises follow periodized programs where your training is split into chunks with different focuses. And all of those chunks include the rest period at the end, which is essential. And then the first stage of your training, that is usually referred to as base fitness, is mostly an attempt to undo some of the damage that happens when you're exercising at a high intensity, and mm-hmm. to undo the imbalances that are the result of the exercises that you do. And that rest phase, and then that base fitness phase, like, that is the foundation that makes everything else possible. So when you see an athlete who does something truly incredible, and you see videos of their high intensity training, what you're seeing there is kind of the tail end of that whole phase that they've gone through. And the bulk of it is spent resting, mm-hmm. base fitness, and then the strength phase, which requires a ton of patience, a lot of focus. The movement is usually quite slow, and the intensity can be high, but again, patience and consistency over and over and over. And then you get this short little peak where you get to kind of have fun and mm-hmm. you know, do the exercise you want to do as hard as you want and as fast as you want. But it's so draining that you only really get a short period of time where you can do that safely, and then you have to go back to rest, base training, and the cycle repeats itself.
Yeah, and I don't actually, in my case, I don't mind that at all right now. In terms of, like, I'm very appreciative of slow movement training, and I think I'm feel so privileged that I had the time that I had with you, one on one, to able to come to a point. And I think we were almost at a point where I was feeling balanced within myself, and I was beginning to truly appreciate. And I remember, like, when I'm training with you, I'm also thinking, okay, how is this movement supposed to feel? Because mm-hmm. I want to be able to do that on my own, and have the correct feeling mm-hmm. for it as well. Because I'm not looking, you know, when you and I were training, we're not looking at mirrors. We're more going with how it's supposed to be.
That's right.
Feeling, not looking at a mirror and seeing, oh, what is your form? What is your form supposed to be? And I find that it was very interesting way, because it's very intuitive, mm-hmm. intuitive way of moving. And what is motivating you right now? What are you doing in terms of your own training at the moment, Ben?
Not as much as I would like.
Yeah.
Spending a lot of time. We're going on a lot of walks and a lot of bike rides. I can't rock climb, which is really too bad. I have some training equipment that I can use at home. Mm-hmm. But I'm taking the opportunity to treat this as a, you know, if it was a periodized program, which I was following until the pandemic started, as a big, long base fitness phase. So I'm doing a lot of plank progressions and bird dogs, and I have a chronic injury in my right shoulder.
Yeah.
So I'm spending a lot of time on that, trying to just reduce the irritation in it. I have a tear in my labrum and a tear in one of my rotator cuff muscles. Mm-hmm. And those things, those won't get better per se. So what you have to do in those situations is manage them, and try to keep the irritation and the negative effects as low as possible. So right now it's a lot of those simple, physically easy, but sometimes psychologically exhausting exercises.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of focus, lots of concentration.
How do you motivate yourself then? What are you using? What tools are you using to motivate yourself to get
there? A good question. I've always had a really hard time sitting still. So I sometimes have a hard time answering that question about what motivates me, because what I find really difficult would be to sit still for a long period of time. I'm always moving my hands and tapping my feet, so it's kind of second nature for me. But to do these really psychologically draining exercises, it took for me in my early to mid-20s about a five-year period where I was always handling some kind of minor injury that was really interfering with what I wanted to be doing, which was mm-hmm. rock climbing. And it was about a maybe a 4-year period where I was constantly either my shoulders or my fingers, because fingers are really important for rock climbing, were injured. And it took the help of a personal trainer friend of mine. I said, I can't figure out why I keep getting injured all the time. And then he started asking me the really basic questions that any personal trainer would ask a new client about, you know, what do you do about imbalances? What are you doing for injury prevention and management? And I realized that I was being a horrible personal trainer for myself. My programs were all geared around what I found to be the most fun. I was trying to emulate the elite athletes who are a lot more fit and a lot more capable at doing these exercises than I am. And they have a lot more
resources as well. We don't want to forget that either.
That's right. A lot more resources and a lot more time. And most of them started at a really young age. So I started, you know, my exercise climbing, I started at about age 18. Most professionals in a sport started sometimes as early as 3 or 4 to get into the movement.
Yeah.
So what I try to remind myself of is that I'd be deluding myself if I thought that I could have it all, in the sense that I can keep climbing at the level that I want to climb and not do the prerequisite training that you have to do. And you can get away with that if you're lucky. You can get away with it for a while when you're young, but it catches up to everybody eventually.
And injuries come back. Like, injuries definitely doesn't matter when you're doing it. Yeah. Like, there's a lot of data behind it and science behind, that injuries do come back.
Yeah, and I see that a lot in the difference between a person in their early 20s who wants to get some coaching and a person in their early 30s is almost bigger than any other age group in my experience, because a lot of the people in their early 20s, they still are operating under the belief that they're the exception to the physiological rule that your body will break down in some way at some point. And then by the time you've had a couple injuries, you're faced with the decision of, do you want to put in the really hard work and the boring work to prevent that, or do you want to roll the dice? And for me, I constantly remind myself that those are the two choices that I have, that I can engage in the exercises that I don't really want to do, but they get me where I need to be to do the exercises that I do want, or I can roll the dice, and in my experience, that almost always ends up with an injury, and then you don't get to do the fun exercises or the boring exercises.
And I think that's an issue that, in terms of sports as well, that's not something we put in the forefront either. Like, regardless, like, of whether you're an elite athlete or otherwise, that's something, that kind of movement training, that kind of functional movement training should be a part of our education from the very beginning. I cannot say this enough, that how important it is to teach our children how to do a plank, bird dog, or a squat, like, early on, and keep that focus ongoing, because it's not just about whether or not you're going to become an elite athlete. That's, like, not even the point of this. The point of it is to, for your physical and mental well-being, to be able to move your body, I think, is so incredibly important in terms of not just physical well-being, but also your mental well-being.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something that we really now would be a good idea to introduce, especially now the kids are sitting at home for long periods of time and are not as mobile as they ought to be, considering the circumstances. And it's not just them, it's adults as well. And so how often are you moving, you find,
throughout the day? All day long. It's easier, I think, when you have young kids. Children.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, my son has, he's going through a superhero phase. We bought him some capes and some masks, and so he spends a good chunk of his day pretending to be Superman or Iron Man. Spider-Man is his favorite, and he enlists us to play his imaginary superhero games, which involve mostly running from room to room.
Yep, I remember.
Crawling around on the floor.
Very much so.
Yeah. Lots of play fighting with him, play wrestling and jumping around. And he likes to be, he's getting a little too heavy for it, but he likes me to throw him up in the air and catch him. So I have outlets for exercise all day long.
And yeah, no, that's wonderful. And what about some of your clients that are elderly? What are you interacting with them by any chance?
Communicating by email. Mm-hmm. What we did at the gym I work at, where I work at, called Focus Fitness. Mm-hmm. What the owner did when COVID really, when everything shut down, is he gathered together the video database for exercises that one of the trainers had put together, and then all the trainers who worked at the gym, we were all, which I was actually really happy about, we all got laid off because it allowed us to look at, you know, EI and the curb benefit and other things. And then he's offering for every member of the gym different membership packages that they can do virtually. So they do classes through Zoom 3 times a week, and then you have different options for training where you can, it can start with just being given a program that you can work on, and then you can ramp it up to having, you know, virtual sessions with a trainer where they have a video link with you so they can monitor your exercise. And then when a client signs up for that, the personal trainer who was working with them gets involved to guide program development.
Oh, nice. And that's working out well. I think a lot of gyms are doing that as well. From what I hear, I think CrossFit is also doing that sort of stuff.
To be working really well.
Yeah, as well as martial arts too. I found that very interesting.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about, I've been thinking about motivation a lot, because you and I talked about that previously as to what is what motivates you to be able to move, because brain is basically trying to conserve the energy, right? We're still in the African savanna, and we're still trying, it's still going out for conservation of energy. That's why physical exercises, it's hard. That's why we have gyms and we have personal trainers and all of those things, because it's like as natural as it should be, it's not. Or because the way we have our societies functioning, it also makes it much harder. Mm-hmm. Then, especially in our countries, in North America, because if it's very different in countries, like especially in the Nordic countries, or even in Asian countries, because part of the Asian countries is how they sit and how, you know, squatting and all of that is a very big part of their everyday life. And Nordic countries have made exercises part of their culture. How they move about, like they have amazing bike lanes, and kids are taught to play in nature from the very beginning, which is, and we have kind of separated. We have these chunks of time that we dedicate to gym time.
And that's not a good, there's nothing you can do in 1 hour that's going to make up for 23 hours of being sedentary.
Indeed. And there's lots of data to back that up. Plenty of studies that are coming out and talking about, like, you know, that even if you did high intensity training and then you're sitting down for 12 hours, it's actually not beneficial. Now you need to move.
It's really
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's really difficult in any way to go against the grain. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, we don't have we have an exercise culture for some, but it often what we see is that high intensity push past the pain for 20 minutes exercise. And that's in my mind, that's not the best recipe for most people, but we don't have much of a culture around lower intensity, regular exercise. So Canada's 24-hour movement guidelines, in the section where they discuss work, there's recommendations for walking meetings for people who work in businesses. So you'd walk around the office having your meeting instead of being seated. But the practical barriers that brings up, if you need access to technology or a computer, it's so much easier. And we have such a habit of being seated at work and for meetings. And so to work against that grain is really difficult.
Yeah, and that's part of like the school system too, right? Like you have kids sitting down for periods of time.
Which is insane, particularly for a young child, to have them sitting still. It's a disaster.
It is, in so many different ways, and that goes for learning as well. Like it's going to compromise learning if you're not being able to move. Moving is such a it it is such a big part and process of the learning itself.
Absolutely.
That it just compromises us at so many different levels. I've been finding it's very interesting because now I'm mostly housebound. And for the first little while, I was we were in isolation. And I had to reconfigure my entire space. And I remember doing that when my kids were little and I was doing shift work, which I had to create a house where they're able to run and move right. and be able to jump because I didn't want my daytime sleep, which was very important to me as well, compromise their ability to move around the house when they needed to move. And I had to we created padded hallways.
Oh, that's a good idea.
As if you would in a gym. Yeah. So they were able to move, and there were areas that were dedicated to jumping. Like I knew
Excellent.
That, you know how kids, they're like jumping on the couch and from the couch yeah. to the floor.
Yeah.
So we created these spaces for them to be able to do that. And it's funny now that I have to recreate that space for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I feel like I'm sitting now for longer periods because on an yeah. average day, I walked around 12 kilometers a day. Was my average day. And now I'm not doing that. And I have to figure yeah. out like small bursts of intense training combined yeah. with slow movement training and then dedicated slow movement training, but in small bursts because it has to be divided out throughout the day now. I don't have a dedicated time that I'm walking from here to here, or I'm going to the gym to train for an hour or so. And yeah. so, but that itself is taking a long time. And I've been thinking again about motivation.
Yeah.
Because with you, that's an innate part of you was like being able to just wanting to move, right? But that's not the same thing with me. I can sit. If I needed to sit for a while, because I have to I'm reading a lot and making lots of notes, and that's been a part and process of my life. And I can do that, but I sometimes get so involved in my work that I now have to set alarms to say, oh, wait,
right.
stop whatever you're doing for a little bit and move.
Yeah.
Because once you start writing or you're reading or you're writing and you're making notes, you can actually forget.
Yeah, and hours can go by.
Yeah, it can sometimes.
Motivation is finding what motivates an individual is so critical, and it's really different from person to person.
Yes, of course.
Some people, you and I, are probably on the same wavelength in that we're pretty cerebral about exercise, so we like and get a lot of value out of thinking, you know, really intensely about how this feels. And you mm-hmm. can, you and I have done this before where we might spend a good chunk of a session only talking about, you know, subtle changes in the position of your foot
yeah.
when you're doing a lunge. And that's forgetting about, you know, moving upstream, the knee, the hip, the core, breathing. You can spend as much time as you want to digging into the nitty gritty details of an exercise. And that works really well for some people to motivate them. For other people, that's the worst approach because if they don't enjoy it, it drives them away. Finding a way to make it fun is, I think, maybe the most important step that you can take. If you want to exercise more, but if it's not a practical or a financial barrier, if the barrier is more behavioral mm-hmm. and you just can't find a way to get in it, then I would, in that situation, recommend that people not worry quite as much about that elusive, you know, quote unquote best type of exercise, because and focus on finding something that's fun, because the best exercise for a person is the one that they will do. And I think if I'm remembering this right, that dropout rates in the US for people with gym memberships in any given year period is well above 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those people will never go back to the gym again. So, if I put on my coach hat here mm-hmm. for a second, when a new client comes to the gym, I'm much more focused in the first sessions, in the first weeks, and finding out what it is that they enjoy and what gives them a sense of satisfaction than I am focused on the physiological side of it and at looking at how the joints move in terms of performance. Because if it's not fun, people won't do it. And as a trainer, if someone comes to you, which is really difficult for a lot of people, you know, to acknowledge that they're not as physically healthy as they want to be, and then to come and be as much as we smile and try to make it light, you know, you're when you're with a trainer, you're being somewhat scrutinized by them. They've got their eyes on you and they're watching you and they're giving a lot of feedback, and it's pretty stressful for people. So if you can't find a way to keep your client motivated and they leave, they might never exercise again. So it's got to be fun. And there are really, really healthy people who do totally different styles of exercise, right? You've distance runners, sprinters, people who do powerlifting, yoga, CrossFit, bodybuilding. Like there's so many different ways exercises. There's so many different ways to move, and they work your body in so many different ways. But if you can find one that you enjoy and you can find something that you'll stick to, then you're going to be physically healthier than you were before. And even if it's not that, you know, that quote unquote best exercise, even if it's something that leaves your body a little bit unbalanced, or maybe it's hard on your joints in some ways, if the choice is between exercise that is a little hard on your joints and no exercise at all, I think in almost all situations that the exercise that's hard on your joint is the better choice.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
The effects of sedentary life are so severe.
Worse. Absolutely.
Far worse.
And not just like on your physical, but also on the economics of the person and economics of our healthcare system as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's that was very interesting because you are a rock climber and I became a mountain climber because of you.
That's right.
Because we trained for... When we first trained, we were training for 9 months, and I needed to set a new goal because I was coming out of this disastrous injury, and I needed to set a new goal to see, okay, how I can move in a different way. And I projected that, okay, if I set a goal that I will be climbing a mountain anywhere, doesn't matter how high it is or whatever, if I set myself up for that, then I can slowly start training myself for that. And that also brought a lot of patience as well, because training for climbing a mountain was a very different way to move, and it required long periods of just like going up and down Fort Henry Hill, you know, just training my legs prior to climbing, because that was the hill that was available to me multiple times. And then climbing the stairs at Kingston General multiple times. Like, you know, I would maybe instead of going 400 stairs, I'd upped my game. I think around that time I was just prior to climbing, I'd gone up to 800 stairs.
Excellent.
Which was like also, it's a very, it sounds very mundane, just climbing, you know, that's all you're doing. But it also taught me a lot of about patience as well, to take your time with things. Like, take your time with form, take your time with things. That the goal is there. There's no reason, especially in terms of physical, to rush it to that particular point. Because if you get injured, then it's a massive setback as well.
Yes, it is. The idea of grit and, you know, pushing through the pain. The one area where there actually is a big place for that is with that slow movement stuff and the base training and the, you know, the injury prevention stuff. The athletes that I've trained and outside of sports, the individuals that I've trained who have high levels of success and really, you know, impress themselves and impress me with what they can accomplish are the ones who can tolerate doing things that they really don't want to do, and doing them over and over and over and over. And that takes a certain mindset. It's hard to develop it, and it's mm-hmm. it's hard to do it, but the benefits outside of exercise are innumerable, because it's you know, whether it's doing glute bridges really slowly and really focusing on the way your glutes contract when you really don't want to, or it's, you know, going through an aspect of your work life that you really aren't motivated to do, building that mental toughness will yield benefits way outside of your exercise and long after the exercise stops.
Mm-hmm. I found that too. I think part of that was also physical, training myself physically and teaching myself the patience of it all, and waiting to like make sure the form was accurate and appreciating that. That had benefits all, like not just to my physical movements, definitely to how I moved through life,
mm-hmm.
period. I noticed that with martial arts too. With martial arts was very much about your environment and being aware of what's around you and what's coming at you, and yes. kind of sharpening those kinds of senses. And I remember how it played a role as to how I started to move within my environment. It totally changed how I moved in life, like how I stood, how I moved, how I sat, how I saw the world. And I think it's so nicely correlated. Both the mental and the physical are so beautifully tied in that I really think, like, as a society, we really need to focus on that. I think it'll just make us better humans.
Yeah, better I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. I can give you an example from my own exercise experience. There's rock climbing is an interesting sport, and there's a lot of different subdivisions of it. I like to spend my time outdoors. More remote settings are better for me. And there's a particular type of climbing that you can engage in called on-site climbing. And what on-site means is for any given route, and I'll just make the distinction here between mountaineering and climbing. Mountaineering, you might not use a rope, or you might use a rope. The kind of rock climbing I do, you're always attached to the rope,
yes.
because the rock is vertical, or it yep. might be more than vertical and overhanging. So that gives you an idea of mm-hmm. what it looks like. But in on-site climbing, you don't know anything about the route that you're about to climb. So you won't know where the handholds are, where the footholds are, what orientation they are. You can go into it with an understanding of approximately how difficult it is, but that's the only thing you know. And when you do on-site climbing, the amount of, if you're successful in it, you get right to the top of the route without falling. If you fall and your weight goes back on your rope, then then that's it. You only ever get one try to on-site something. And if you don't get it on your first try, then you just move on.
Mm-hmm.
But the level of focus and restraint that is required for that is monumental. And it's, for me, every time I try to do an on-site that's a little bit harder than something I've done before, if I make it past halfway up the route or three quarters of the route, the stress and the panic of it often hits really hard, because the closer I get to the top, the more I get pulled out of the moment. And mm-hmm. the more I realize, like, oh, I'm about to do this. This is going to feel so good. I can't wait. And it's so difficult to bring yourself back fully into what you're doing once you realize that your mind has wandered away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the added factor of, you know, being a couple hundred feet above the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But those experiences I've found have been really helpful in any situation where I need to maintain focus around distractions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, I can be sitting at my computer trying to mark papers when my kids are running up and down the hallway trying to distract me, or, you know,
I can hear them in the background right now.
They're up from their nap now, so they're running around getting their game started. And it's, you know, any sport or exercise or activity that you engage in, if you walk down that road of you know, focusing really intensely on what you're doing and being really, really present in your body, that's a skill that extends way beyond exercise.
Oh, yeah,
and you
absolutely.
Can use that. It's like I said, it's just mental toughness, and you can use that for any situation.
Yeah, and I think it's something that's a skill that should be taught at the very beginning. That should be part and parcel of our education, as I've mentioned
absolutely.
Already. I think that would really, that would help us in so many different ways. Because otherwise it becomes really, really difficult, as especially as you start to age, to be able to learn to move in a different way.
Yeah.
And I think it's would be greatly helpful.
Yeah,
to
and
our
people
society.
Come to exercise, particularly older adults. They come to exercise because they don't know how to do it in a way that's not going to hurt them. And
exactly.
If we could, as a culture, as a society, if we could instill that knowledge in children and adolescents, they'd never lose it. Like someone who learns how to, most of us in Canada would learn how to skate as kids. And as long as you learn it as a kid, you're never really going to lose it. If you learn how to ride a bicycle as a kid, you'll always be able to pick it back up. But if you don't learn it when you're young and you try to pick it up later in life, there's always success stories, but it's significantly harder.
Yeah, and I think also making like our cities places where we are able to do all of these things, that it's not just for a select few.
Yeah.
That it's kind of open to everybody, and making cities very friendly for movement would be incredibly helpful.
Yeah. Which they often aren't right now.
No, they're not. No.
North America is really known for sprawl.
But I did notice that in Australia. When I was...
Oh, is that right?
I went for a run. Yeah, I went for a run at the Bondi Beach. Like, actually, I went for a run across the three beaches that are connected. I was actually one of the... Of all the runs I've had in my life, that was one of the best runs I've had. First
of all,
because it was so incredible, because it was going up and down these jagged mountains and the water's right there. But what I noticed was that how they had these stations everywhere, whether you could do pull-ups and push-ups and all of these, like, distributed throughout everywhere where everybody could move in a different way. And I was thinking, wow, that would be such an incredible thing to do, because for a while I was really interested in the parkour movements. Because I liked the idea of using the urban space as a gym. If you didn't have how you would navigate through the city. But I thought if cities made it friendly in terms of whether we're biking or walking, if those places were more available to us, then we'll be able to utilize them. And then you add the component of educating it at a very young age and making that an everyday part of your being. Then I think it would serve our society well, both physically and mentally.
Absolutely. It would be a massive service to the next generation and the ones after that. There's so many practical and financial barriers to exercise, particularly because we live in a northern climate. If you want, I do a lot of outdoor exercise in the winter, cross country skiing and snowshoeing mostly. But
that's
you need that input of funding to do that, to buy your skis, to buy your snowshoes. It's really helpful to have your own vehicle if you want to, and to have space if your home or your apartment is small and full of your items and there's not room left over for exercise, then your only option to get it in the winter months would be
a gym.
You have to be paying money somewhere to do it. Artillery Park does a good job of keeping their costs as low as possible. But I think that as a society, we even just from an economic perspective, we could save money in the long term if we removed those financial barriers to exercise for people.
And making it like accessible and available to everybody, because if you're looking at the cost of it, it's significant. Like, you know, one-on-one personal training is costly. It's quite significant. And I think when I'm doing that one-on-one training, I'm keeping that in my like back of my head, is like, this is the money that you're dedicating towards your physical self, so every second of this counts.
Absolutely.
Like when I go in, sometimes I remember I couldn't talk to you because my focus was so focused completely on the training component that we couldn't like have a conversation sometimes. And also because sometimes I had only the energy to focus on exercise too.
Yeah.
But I remember, like, I always think about that if I'm putting this much money into my physical well-being, then every second of it should count. Well, it's been so wonderful talking to you, Ben.
I'm really glad you had me on. This has been great.
And I hope you're going to be able to come back at some point and we can have further our conversation on this. And let me, like, it would be good to know where you are with your own physical training in the next couple of months' time, too. We can touch base and see what methods we've come up with. Because I think I'm studying it and you're studying it, and it would be good to bring this back to the audience and maybe bring in a couple more people who are training on their own.
I think that'd be great, and we could take a closer look at the specific exercise modalities that we've all been using. Yeah, I think that'd be fantastic.
And changing the space around within the house to see how we move in it as well.
Absolutely. I had a video uploaded to the Focus Fitness Facebook page with my son, Wynn, and it was a short video that just showed everybody, this is three different ways you can do a squat while holding on to your child. So we had the three different ways that you could hold your child to do a squat and the relative benefits of each.
Yeah.
So it'd be fun to dig more into that.
I started dancing a lot. Which,
oh great,
which was part and parcel of my package. Like, I did dancing in my 20s and performed, but I also, and I've been dancing intermittently, but now it's a very big part of my how I move through my house sometimes is just through movement, and it's very interesting and fun.
Fantastic.
So let's connect soon.
And that sounds great.
Yeah, it was wonderful chatting with you. Thank you everyone for joining us for this episode. We will connect soon.
Thank you for listening to the Ruhi Sleep, Sleep and Society podcast, available on ruhisleep.ca. Don't forget to follow us on social media @ruhisleep on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thank you for listening.